Hello and welcome to Mythmakers. Mythmakers is the podcast for fantasy fans and fantasy creatives brought to you by the Oxford Centre for Fantasy. My name is Julia Golding. I'm an author, but I also run the centre. And today I'm joined by someone from the publishing world. So please meet Daniel Seaton, who works for a very interesting publisher in the UK called the Pushkin Press. So hello to Daniel.
Hello. Thanks very much for having me on. It's very exciting.
So, many people who are, keen on fantasy could imagine themselves working in the world of publishing fantasy books and other kinds of books. So, how did you, as a young man, actually get into publishing? What was your route?
Well, I suspect it's quite a common route, really. University, I studied French and philosophy. So I came out of university without there was no obvious career path for that degree necessarily. So I always had to think about, what do I really love? And what I really loved was reading and books, and had done since for all my life, really, all my life that I can remember. And so I started working in publishing, and I've been studying a language at university, it seemed natural to go into the area of publishing that focuses on translations, which is what I did. And after a few years, I ended up at Pushkin Press. That's coming up for 12 years now, 12 years ago that I came here. And now I'm an editor. And in that time, we've really gone from strength to strength. It's been a great place to work.
So what is the place of fantasy within the raft of things that you publish at Pushkin?
Well, we don't specialise in publishing fantasy. We're not that sort of publisher, but I think there are elements of fantasy in all of the different strands of what we publish. So what we originally were founded to publish, and what we were best known for, is translated classic literature from across the world. And that was what we were publishing when we were first founded in 1997. But since then, we've really broadened out. And now we publish a lot of contemporary literature, as well as we have a children's list and a crime and thrillers list as well. And I actually acquire and publish across all of those lists. And I suppose there's fantastical elements in lots of those titles and lots of those imprints, but really it's the children's list which has the largest element of fantasy in it, and the one that actually I think I enjoy acquiring for the most. It's something that I'm starting to focus on. Yeah, we publish a lot of wonderful fantasy novels from all over the world on that list.
So perhaps you could give the listeners an idea of what some of those titles might be that fall into that category.
Well, for example, I think the most successful title on our children's list since we founded it has been a Dutch classic called The Letter for the King by an author called Tonke Dracht. It's a wonderful, it's fantasy in the sense that it's set in not in our world, but it's a fantasy perhaps a bit like Game of Thrones, purely in the sense that the fantastical, magical elements are quite downplayed. So it's quite a realistic fantasy, which I think is quite Dutch, really. It's a very taut, fast-paced adventure story about a young squire who wants to become a knight. And to do that, he has to deliver a letter to the king of a far-off land. And there are all these other knights trying to stop him. It's really just a breathless story. And it's a huge classic in the Netherlands, across the world. And we published it with great success in the UK, and it was recently adapted by Netflix for a brilliant series as well. So that's one example. Another example would be another book from the Netherlands, actually. it's interesting because when I speak to people from the Netherlands, they often say that fantasy is something that is quite lacking from Dutch literature in general. It's often very realistic. But I think perhaps because of that, when a Dutch fantasy novel does emerge, it's often very special. And that's the case for a book called Lampie that we published a couple of years back by an author called Annette Sharp. It ended up being the first translated book to be shortlisted for the Carnegie Medal in the UK. And that's a wonderful gothic secret garden-esque fantasy novel about a young girl with mermaids and pirates, and it's very rich and astute on a level of character as well, like the sink that was a big influence for Annette when she was writing it. Like, I really love that book, and we've got her next book coming out this autumn, which is called The Girls, which is a collection of stories, actually.
I mean, the reason we got to know each other is that you very kindly were sending me some of these wonderful books to review. Yes. And I remember that one very much. But the one that I remember, of course, is My Favourite Ape.
Oh, The Murderer's Ape, yeah. I almost didn't mention that because it's so... I mean, that is, I think, perhaps my favourite book on that we've ever published across all of our imprints. It's so amazing. It's the author is Swedish, and it's a very rich, old-fashioned kind of 1920s set adventure in a kind of Tintin-esque style. And the one fantastical element of it really is that the protagonist is a gorilla called Sally Jones, who she can't speak, but she can understand everything that humans say, and she's alongside humans in their world, and she actually works as a mechanic on board a boat, which enables her to sail around the world and have lots of adventures. And it's really just an amazing, richly detailed adventure of the type that I think we don't see enough of these days. And it's beautifully illustrated as well. It has about 100 gorgeous detailed illustrations by the author in it. We're publishing the paperback edition of the sequel, Sally Jones and the False Rose, this autumn, which is another just as good as The Murderer's Ape, and which Sally Jones comes to Glasgow, in fact, so it's UK-based. The only reason I didn't mention that right away is because, the only fantastical element, if you could call it that, is that she's a gorilla, which is, you know...
It does an extremely good job of persuading you that it's a historical adventure.
Yes.
And you have to actually take a step back and think, hang on a minute. would a gorilla really be able to be a mechanic? Is this not actually a form of animal fable in a way? And it is actually, I'll put my hand up, it's my, when anyone says, what's your favourite children's book you've read in the last decade? It's that one. Adore it. The other thing I like about both that and the Lampy story and others is illustration, because it struck me that whereas in the UK you might get chapter vignettes or whatever, it's quite rare for a publisher, unless you're doing an illustrated book of the sort of children, you know, younger end of the market, people don't spend on the illustrations. Whereas the European editions that you're translating seem to have the most wonderful place for illustrations. Am I right in thinking that? Is that something that you've noticed?
Yes. I mean, in the case of those two books, the authors did the illustrations as well. So and Annette Sharp, for example, and I think both Annette Sharp, author of Lampy, and Jakob Wegelius, author of The Murderer's Ape, they started out as illustrators before they started writing these novels for children. So so the book, the story, the illustrations came with the novels. It was already a package, but it's true. I think in the UK we have this culture whereby we have picture books for younger children, and then there's a cutoff, and you have novels for around about 7 or 8, where you start having novels with not so many pictures in them. Whereas on the continent in Europe, I see more of a continuum with perhaps they're just text getting longer and longer and the pitch taking slightly more of a back, but there's still that mix like all the way through, something we could learn from, definitely.
I mean, it's not to say there isn't a place, because obviously there's a whole new range of graphic novels where, you know, the balance is obviously towards pictures and what have you. But it does seem as though for sort of common or garden novelists like me, that I'd love to have more opportunity to work with illustrators in that middle group, the middle grade book. Because when you think of the fantasy greats like oh, I don't know, Lion and the Witch and the Wardrobe. It's in my head. I can't separate it from the Pauline Baynes line drawings. And of course, Tolkien himself was his own best illustrator. And we all know, if I said, oh, yes, Smaug on the treasure heap, everybody knows what I'm talking about. So I think that the example coming in from Europe is one that I'd love to see more frequently used, really. Give illustrators some jobs. That's what I'm saying. what do you think are the main shifts in publishing, particularly as regards fantasy? I mean, I'm talking across the board because we don't just do children's fantasy. We're looking through the whole range of ages on books. Where is it going at the moment in 2022?
Well, that's a big question. And, you know, as an editor, I'm not a specialist in fantasy per se, so it's not my whole focus. But it seems to me like one of the most interesting developments in fantasy literature is kind of linked to one of the biggest trends over the past few years in publishing, which is just bringing in a more diverse range of voices. And I think the effect that has in fantasy is that we're seeing all these fantasy worlds with just different kind of cultural flavors to them that is so exciting and so interesting. I think perhaps because of the great success of Tolkien and other authors like that, almost got to thinking that fantasy means this medieval magical world, whereas in fact what we're getting to experience now is it was all these fantasy worlds influenced by different cultures and different mythologies and beliefs and histories, which I think is really exciting. We published a Chinese fantasy novel on our list a few years back that was very successful, called The Beast Player by Naoko Uehashi. And I think what people really responded to in that is that the fantasy world is just so richly imagined and detailed, but not in the way that Western fantasy readers are necessarily used to. It's really fascinating.
I can remember the experience of watching Spirited Away, you know, that wonderful Japanese film from, I think it's now from the early 2000s, so it's quite old now anyway, or late 1990s. I remember watching this thinking, I have not seen this before. There is nothing here that I've seen before. The imagery, the pacing, everything was just delightfully different and appealing. I agree with you. It's very good to have the formulas shaken up, or the formulas exploded, because new things are coming in. And when we're teaching people on our fantasy course, one of the very first things we're looking at is what's in your own background and the place you live, your own stories that haven't been used before. And it's really exciting if someone comes up with, oh, well, you know, I'm from a Native American background, or I'm from Australia, or whatever. You get new ideas coming through, which is, you know, that's what we're about. We're about new creativity.
Yeah.
So what about the different flavors of fantasy from different countries that you see? Because, I mean, I can say in crime, like we all know about Scandi Noir and cozy crime from the UK and so on. So you can sort of say there are different flavors in the sort of crime and detective world. What would you know, you've mentioned Holland or the Netherlands a couple of times. Do you feel there are sort of different flavors you're getting from different parts of the world as they come across your desk in translation?
Yes, well, it certainly seems that some countries have got very rich traditions that I enjoy delving into. I mean, because I did French at university, I suppose that it's so natural that I end up reading quite a lot of French fantasy submissions. And the breadth of the imagination is really impressive. It's very very creative.
Thank you for listening to part one of this week's podcast. Come back next week to hear part two. Thank you for listening to Mythmakers.
Thanks for listening to Mythmakers podcast, brought to you by the Oxford Centre for Fantasy. Visit oxfordcentrefantasy.org to join in the fun. Find out about our online courses, in-person stays in Oxford, plus visit our shop for great gifts. Tell a friend and subscribe wherever you find your favourite podcasts worldwide.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.